from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Against the old odds, maybe, Patti Smith has risen to the status of cultural icon. Punk rocker, poet, a breakout prose master in her 2010 National Book Award-winning Just Kids. Her first big album, Horses, came out in 1975, 40 years ago. She sang, "I hope I die before I get old." But Patti Smith is very much alive and with us. This hour on Point, Patti Smith and her new memoir, M Train. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What's your question for Patti Smith now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Patti Smith joins me from New York. Her new book is M Train. It's impressionistic, romantic, full of texture and memory and the magic of vibrant people and things like coffee. And more. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Patti Smith in New York, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, hello, Tom. I'm really happy to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. I loved talking with you about Just Kids. I loved the clean, crisp, cutting prose of that book. And this time, it's an entirely different approach to, just to the prose itself. It's quite a transformation. Describe the mindset you were in, Patti, when you went down this much more sort of impressionistic, poetic road.
Well, the book, the title of the book, M Train, you're exactly right, is symbolic of mind train. It's really, you know, it was a mental train. Whatever came to mind, I wrote about. When I wrote Just Kids, I had such a responsible agenda to write about Robert, all of the people we knew in the 70s, and New York City itself, a very strict chronology and a lot of responsibility. So I wanted to write something that had no agenda, that had no outline. I just wanted to write and hop on the train and see where it took me.
You famously sang the Who lyrics way back when, you know, "I hope I die before I get old." And of course, some people do and some people don't. You haven't.
No, in fact, I've rewritten that. When I sing it now, I say a little, probably can't say it on TV, but I change the lyrics and it rhymes with "hope I live because of it." And, you know, I'm happy to be alive. When I was young, I was often ill, sometimes physically fragile. I didn't expect to live a long time, but now that I have crossed that line, I hope I live till I'm 102.
You outlived and wrote beautifully, of course, about Robert Mapplethorpe. You outlived your husband, Freddie Sonic Smith, by many years now. You're 68. You seem very robust.
Well,
what's it like to leave those loved ones so much in the rearview mirror? A lot of people deal with this. Present in your book.
I try. I mean, first of all, they're not quite in my rearview mirror, except chronologically.
True.
I walk with them. They're with me every day. I continue dialogues with Robert when I'm working, taking photographs or working on a specific piece of a drawing or something. I still access Robert, the things I learned from him, the things we collaborated. And my husband is always with me within our children, my memories. It was funny because you started with Dancing Barefoot, which I wrote for Fred. And but he's always with me. I see him magnified in my son and our son and daughter. And so I guess with my mother, with all the people that I've loved and still love and lost, I keep them. I keep them with me, and that I keep them present. It sometimes that's painful because, like a child trying to talk to a doll. You know, every once in a while as a child, you believe in how the doll can really talk to you, but sometimes you just shake it because you want it to really talk. But most of the time, I'm content having them walk with me.
Though, I mean, there's one point in the book you made me just weep. I mean, a lot of people have lost loved ones. You have. I have. And you've got a point. I think you're flying back from Japan. And you say, mid-flight, I began to weep. And you're thinking about Freddie. You say, mid-flight, I began to weep. Just come back, I was thinking. You've been gone long enough. Just come back. I'll stop traveling. I'll wash your clothes. Just come back. Who has lost someone important doesn't know that feeling.
Yeah, well, sometimes we go along and we're fine, and then all of a sudden we feel almost like a spoiled child. Like, all right, that's enough. You know, we've played that game, and I want you back here. And I think we all go through those moments, and they're some of the most difficult moments of all, not in the missing, but in the wanting.
I don't know about you. I don't know how much of a tech person you are if you've got a smartphone in your pocket all the time. Sometimes I just have this terrible urge just to dial some number and find that person on the other end.
Oh, I have both kinds of phones. I have I use my landline a lot. I still sometimes impulsively pick up the phone to call my mother. And my mother died in 2001.
Yeah.
I still do that. But I still, every once in a while, see a shirt or something that Fred would like and take it off the hook in a store ready to buy it and suddenly remember. Those impulses stay with us.
Patty, would you read a little bit from the new book, M-Train, from maybe the last essay here, the last chapter, The Hour of Noon? It's the last chapter of Patty Smith's M-Train.
Okay. Do you want me to just choose something?
Well, there's something late in there. It starts, we seek to stay present. I don't know if you've got that, even as the ghosts attempt to draw us away. It's just one paragraph into that last chapter.
All right. We seek to stay present, even as the ghosts attempt to draw us away. Our father manning the loom of eternal return. Our mother wandering toward paradise, releasing the thread. In my way of thinking, anything is possible. Life is at the bottom of things, and belief at the top, while the creative impulse, dwelling in the center, informs all. We imagine a house, a rectangle of hope, a room with a single bed with a pale coverlet, a few precious books, walls papered in faded floral. They fall away and burst as a newborn meadow, speckled with sun, and a stream emptying into a greater stream where a small boat awaits us with two glowing oars and one blue sail. Do you want me to continue?
No, that's great. I think we've got the flavor of M-Train. It's beautiful. It's beautiful.
Well, that little boat that I was just mentioning it, that's, you know, those are the little vessels that afford us, you know, mental travel.
You remind us that way back when you were 26, you went out and photographed the grave of Rambo. You're still very much in league with your sort of bad boy posse of Jean Genet and Rambo and William Burroughs. Are you channeling them? Have you always?
Well, I feel intermittently close with people. I would say I don't know if I could say that I exactly channeled them, but I knew William was my friend, so you know, I can hear his voice, I can feel him, I can feel him as a guide. When I was a young girl, especially, I felt Rambo at my side. People say, you know, sometimes people think this is unusual or eccentric, but I don't think it's any more unusual than one feeling the angels with one or guided by saints. We draw from who we need to draw from at different parts of our life.
I love the way you imagine. I mean, you've got also a thing with Ludwig Wittgenstein, Austrian philosopher. You're right. Or maybe Wittgenstein could be my Valentine. We could live in a little red house in cantankerous silence on the side of a mountain in Norway. Oh, you know your Norway.
Well, he did teach there. He did teach in a little red house. And Wittgenstein and Valentine rhyme, so yes. I suppose he would be a good candidate.
It's funny that up in that pantheon, or maybe not quite in the pantheon, but up, you're also a big fan of young adult fiction and Katniss Everdeen and the Hunger Games. How does all that fit together?
Well, I love Katniss Everdeen. I read the Hunger Games because my sister Linda, who I'm very close with, mm-hmm. told me that I reminded her of Katniss. So
that's pretty cool, Jennifer Lawrence. Here comes Patti Smith. Watch
so,
out!
So I mean, when we were young, I was the oldest of my siblings, and I suppose their champion. And they were my great supporters. They really instilled me with a tremendous amount of confidence. And I adored my sister as Katniss adored her sister.
Yeah.
And but yes, I like the Hunger Games.
I want to talk about that and a whole lot more. So great to have you with us from New York.
Thank you.
It's good. Hang in there, Patty.
Patty
Smith
is here.
Good. Don't go away. Patty Smith is with us. Her latest book released this week, a memoir titled M-Train. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Behind us, Land, the centerpiece of Patti Smith's iconic 1975 album, Horses, celebrates its 40th anniversary this year. It's been called one of the top 100 all-time greatest albums by Time Magazine, Rolling Stone. You can join us this hour. What's your question on life, art, memory, writing, singing for Patti Smith? Is she a beacon for you in her way? Where'd she lead you? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook with Patti Smith. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the great Patti Smith, poet of punk, cultural icon, National Book Award winning author, about life and her new impressionistic, poetic memoir, M-Train. You can join us this hour. What's your question on life, art, memory, writing, singing for Patti Smith? Is she a beacon for you? Did you sing Because the Night Belongs to the Lovers with her back in the day? Did you read her memoir of life with Robert Mapplethorpe? Just kids. And what's your question on the grown-up life for Patti Smith on kids and marriage and loss and getting older? Her album Horses came out 40 years ago next month. Our number is 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Behind us, People Have the Power off of Dream of Life in 1988, an album she co-wrote with her late husband Fred Sonic Smith, who died in 1994, best known as guitarist for the rock band MC5. Patti Smith joins us from New York. Lots of comments for you already, Patti. Valeria says, do you know your music is great to listen to while running? Okay, we can hear it right there in that song. Janice says, love the song, Dancing Barefoot. Statement, not question, Jenna writes to us. But Meg says this and goes to the issue of time and how we see ourselves and maybe our work, your art. Meg says, I can assume that many of your fans are heavily invested in your work. Can attest to that. After 40 years creating work that's had a significant emotional interpretation by so many, Meg asks you, Patti, are there times when you wish you could clarify the work of your youth to what you feel the world needs today? A little vagueness, but also I think you get the gist of where she's going there.
Well, I continue working. And I think that all artists have certain themes that they return to in their life. And I think instead of revisiting old work, mm-hmm. I try to, in new work, make things clearer, open, and more communicative. I mean, really, my advice to people always is to take care of themselves, to work hard, to be themselves, be true to themselves, to measure themselves by their actions and by their good deeds and what they do instead of what they have. And especially in our present culture, that's a quite material culture. And just, do the best you can. But I don't know. I'm compelled to keep working.
Let's get a question that goes right, maybe parallel to Meg's. John's calling from New York, Coventry, New York. John, you're on the air with Patty Smith. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I do have a little bit of a follow-up on the past question. Patty, I got to tell you, this is the greatest day of my life. You and
Tom. Oh, no.
You and Tom.
It'll get better, I promise.
My biggest heroes. My question is, on your album, Horses, at the end of it, you shouted out, "We created it, let's take it over." I always wanted to ask you, how do you feel about that statement today? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's part of the live version of my generation, mm-hmm. if I remember. I was really speaking at that time to young people, reminding them that rock and roll was a grassroots experience. It was a grassroots expression. It didn't belong to rock stars or the privileged. It didn't belong to moguls or pop stars. It belonged to the people, and that anyone could have a rock and roll band, that anyone could express themselves, that anyone could use this form for politically, artistically, poetically. And because I did grow up as rock and roll was created, it mm-hmm. was just a bit before my generation. So I saw the entire evolution of rock and roll.
A question right behind that one. John, thanks so much for your call. Emily in Providence, Rhode Island. Emily, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I am wondering if Patty could tell us about how she felt transitioning to creating music as a young person from writing or being really heavy in reading literature, how she felt doing that, and especially as a woman in like a heavy man punk world.
Well, punk the phrase punk rock didn't exist when I was young. Besides that, I came into the performance mode as a poet, performing my poetry. But I had so much agitated energy, and being a child of rock and roll, I wanted to energize and magnify my poetry readings. So it really evolved organically. Lenny Kaye came and played some guitar with me, Richard Soul, some piano, and we evolved just naturally and organically as a rock and roll band. I never really felt fettered by my gender. I never felt suppressed. I know that there was all kinds of things that I had to fight, but that didn't bother me. I was willing to. I had many fights. It wasn't just the gender issue. It was my choice of statements. Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine. Mm. How I dressed. How I presented myself, but I've never felt fettered. An artist is an artist. I don't look at art as having a gender. It's work, and we do our work.
There's this great set of portraits, photographs of you and Freddie early on in the book, and you're one on each page, facing pages, and they're just staring out. They look a little mugshotty, sort of in the way that you both challenge the camera. They're handsome, they're beautiful, but they're artists in the way they so frankly confront the world to my eye. And challengingly. I wish you'd talk a little bit about, in your last book, you talked so deeply and beautifully about your relationship with Robert Mapplethorpe, the photographer, your friend and more as a young person. Could you compare, talk about your relationship with Robert, compare with your relationship with Freddie?
Well, Fred is, those pictures were our visa pictures when we were in French Guiana to go to Brazil.
Yeah.
So that's why I think they have that mugshot look. But Fred and Robert were very different people. I always say that Robert was the artist of my life and Fred was the love of my life. He became my husband, the father of my children, and Robert and I, our work was our children. I both of these men were so important in my evolution for different reasons, and I carry them both with me always. I didn't plan to write about Fred in this book. Mm-hmm. He just appeared. I do have plans for my next book to give the people, the reader, more of Fred. But it just, he just surfaced. And it was both a relief to write about him and somewhat painful. But also I was happy to see him. I began dreaming of him more and as he appeared on the pages. But both of these men were beautiful. They both died in their early 40s, both gifted, both kind. I have to say that Robert was one of the kindest people I ever met. And my husband was a very considerate, complex, but gentle man.
If we could, I'd like to just hear a little bit of you with Fred singing. This is It Takes Time. You co-wrote it with Fred Sonic Smith. This is from 1991 Until the End of the World soundtrack for Wim Wenders' film. Patti Smith and Fred Smith.
One little thing you get wrong changes the dimensions. Streets sweat memory. Confused and lost, like a prayer in the sun.
Fred Smith there in the song It Takes Time with Patti Smith. Patti Smith joins us from New York in the memoirs M Train, and you write in the memoir, Patti, that I guess in 1976 or so, you write, I had met the musician Fred Sonic Smith in Detroit. It was an unexpected encounter that slowly altered the course of my life. My yearning for him permeated everything, my poems, my songs, my heart. You're so good at sharing. Share what it was. At the heart of that relationship, I think we came to understand your relationship with Robert Mapplethorpe. Give us some of the texture at the heart that created that yearning with for Fred.
Well, it's so hard. I'm sorry. I haven't heard his voice in so long.
Oh.
It was
sorry.
Quite moving. So
yeah.
No,
I
it's
imagine.
Fine.
I can imagine.
I'm. It really took my breath away. He had such a beautiful speaking voice.
It is beautiful.
That's why I have to write, write all of this out. Seems like it would take a lifetime to try to explain my relationship with Fred. I think that one word could sum it up. It is alchemy. We had an alchemical relationship. And we produced gold and two children.
Yeah.
And I think that's the best way I could put it
May I give you one more little prompt? Because you write elsewhere in the book, you say, on that same flight where you wanted to talk with him so badly, you said you were watching the movie Master and Commander. And you say, Captain Jack Aubrey, played by
Russell Crowe,
reminded me so much of Fred that you watched the movie twice. Now, it's a long flight. And,
yes.
And at some point in that flight, you were reduced to tears. What was it about Crow or Aubrey or that character that reminded you of Fred?
Well, first of all, Russell Crowe reminds me quite a bit of Fred, just physically. And there's something about him. Russell Crowe has this quality where, you know, he's very, you know, very male.
Yes.
A man's man. Mm-hmm. But he always seems, in his eyes, you see tears.
Yeah.
I mean, I had the pleasure of meeting him and speaking with him. And he has that quality even when you're speaking. He has, you know, a lot of hubris.
Mm-hmm.
And he's one of our great actors, but it's always in his eyes, and I think that's why his characters have such depth. But Captain Jack, he had that very stoic man, a man's man, and you know, a sense of code. His code of honor was so deep and intense that he was actually tricked by another captain who had a less sense of honor.
Yes.
And
because he presumed his own would be shared and it wasn't.
Yes, exactly. And so I think it was a mixture of the character, the captain, and something of Russell himself. Mm-hmm. So because I've had a similar reaction when I saw A Beautiful Mind. So
Russell Crowe again. I want to hear a little bit off your most recent album Banga, released in 2012. Here's This Is the Girl, a tribute to singer Amy Winehouse, who died of alcohol poisoning in 2011, co-written with Tony Shanahan and Stuart Lerman.
This is the girl for whom all tears fall. This is the girl who is having a ball. This is the laurel to crown her head. This is the wine of the house, it is said. This is the blood.
Patti Smith, This Is the Girl. Rachel's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Rachel, you're on with Patti Smith.
Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Patti. Good. How are you doing?
Great.
First of all, I just pulled off the side of the road on my trip to Florida just so I could get a chance to tell you this. It's been my dream to tell you that when I was about 17, I tried to commit suicide because I'd been a victim of childhood sexual abuse for many, many years. And my friends gathered around me and played your music, and you brought me back to life. So you have another child out here. You brought me back to life. You really did. And I've been a fan of yours ever since I was 17. And I was living in Florida where nobody listened to punk or, you know, except for a few of us. And I just want to thank you. It saved my life. I'm almost in tears right now telling you.
Why Patti, Rachel? Why do you think her voice, her message saved you?
It just was so courageous, you know, and it takes courage to live after you've been through what I went through. And it just, every song just burst out of her. And I felt like I could use her energy to live on until I could gain my own strength.
Well, Rachel, I'm certain that you would have found that resilience anyway, because, you know, the desire to live within a human being, that is our natural desire. And I'm very proud of you. And I'm proud that my music helped trigger something that you already had in yourself. So keep that strength. Don't let it go.
Rachel, thank you for calling. That is quite a story. Something in me guesses you're not the only person who may have been saved by Patti Smith. And I appreciate your call so much. Patti Smith's new memoir is M Train. We'll go out at this segment with Privilege, Set Me Free, off out of 1978, off of Easter. And you can join us this hour. What's your question on life, art, memory, writing, singing, remembering for Patti Smith? She's 68 now. Still plenty of courage. 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook with Patti Smith. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the great Patti Smith, poet of punk, cultural icon, National Book Award winning author, about life and her new impressionistic, poetic memoir, M-Train. Behind us, of course, Gloria, classic from her 1975 album Horses, celebrating its 40th anniversary this year. The song, you recall, a kind of mix of them's garage rock song Gloria and a poem Patti had written in 1970 called Oath. Patti is with us in New York today, and you can join us. What do you think of the way she sees the world? Does Patti Smith still speak to you, for you? M-Train has had a... Well, people read it all different ways. I loved it. Michiko Kakutani wrote in the New York Times, "It's an achingly beautiful book, a kaleidoscopic ballad about the losses dealt out by time and chance and circumstance." Travels through time, Kakutani writes, moving from a time when her children were little and, quote, "the things I touched were living, my husband's fingers, a dandelion, a skinned knee," to a time when she increasingly began to capture and memorialize moments from her life in photos and words to create, as an artist, talismanic souvenirs of the past, of which this book, says Kakutani, is one. Patti Smith is with us in New York, and Patti, so many people lined up to talk to you. Diane, Lexington, Massachusetts, you're on the air with Patti Smith.
Diane.
Oh, yes. Hey, Tom, thank you so much for taking my call.
Yeah.
Patti, I just want to just say how much of an influence and inspiration you've been on my life. Hearing the track in the background makes me think of Paul Mall when I saw you live, and I loved your... You know, I love your career. You just spoke to me, and what's so wonderful is that it's kind of come full circle because I have a son, Gabriel, who's 17, and a young poet, and he is so inspired by your work, and we both love just kids, and I can't wait to read your new book, and it's just been so wonderful, and I wanted to just thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Diane, thank you for calling. Patti, Jennifer asks on Twitter, and I bet others are wondering the same, especially when we hear the sort of emotional response to you from longtime listeners. But Jennifer says, how does Patti Smith find such admirable calm and perspective in such a crazy world? We can hear it in your voice. We hear it every time we talk with you, and yet we know your heart and soul are alive to all that craziness. Where do you find the calm?
Well, I'm basically an easygoing person. You know, I sort of mosey through the day. I think that a lot of my emotional intensity is magnified when I'm performing, or if I'm deeply concerned or frustrated because of social injustice. But on the whole, you know, I'm sort of a solitary person. I like to write and draw. I've always been a reader, sort of a bookworm, little bit of a tomboy.
Mm.
But I, as a kid, but, you know, I was always a mediator. You know, I was the oldest of four children, mm-hmm. always trying to keep the peace or help people think about things before they started fighting. It's just part of my nature.
I want to go to David in Oklahoma City. David, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to ask Patty, you've experienced the high adrenaline rush of crowds and rock and roll and that lifestyle, and now you've moved into a more of a subdued lifestyle. And it occurred to me as I was driving along for all of us that either have retired or are moving into a more subdued lifestyle. How did you make that transition from that hard rocking, running?
Well, I have to tell you,
the irony that I listened to you coming out of my radio in high school, and now I'm not quite in my twilight years, but now I'm talking to you on the phone. I just wanted to ask you that.
It's a great question. Well, and talking about a generation, and the question's right there.
I have to say I'm 68 years old.
Yeah.
This summer I did 50 Horses concerts in all over the world. I'm going to do about 20 more. I'm still very physical, still very involved in visceral performing. I just keep balance, but I've always kept balance as best I could. I was a very sickly kid, and so I've always had to be very attentive to taking care of myself. And I have children now, and I want to be there for them. I'm their only parent. I want to live a long time. So, you know, I keep steady on the tightrope, but I'm still plugging my Stratocaster into my amp, and I'm the loudest person in the band. So don't worry about me being too sedentary.
David, let me testify on that front here. I want to read you a little bit from The Guardian. Among that huge lineup of shows that Patty did last summer was the Glastonbury Festival. And here's what The Guardian had to say about her. Just to speak to the more subdued observation, they come no more heroic than Patti Smith, they wrote, coming out of this weekend. The growling grand dame of 70s New York punk explosion, or if you like, the female Lou Reed, she opens. And this is 2 months ago. She opens her set snarling, "Come on, come and love me," during a vitriolic privilege set me free, and ends it falling flat on her face because I'm a miffing animal, and ripping strings from a guitar one by one. In between, the Guardian writes, she reduces half of Glastonbury to tears, empowers the other half, gives the Dalai Lama a birthday cake, and does her damnedest to change the world. Needless to say, it's the set of the weekend. Not so terribly subdued, I guess. And yet, Patty, David is onto something, because there's a lot of this book when you are kind of enveloped in memory, in stillness.
Well, I mean, the thing is, I've often said this, I don't have a persona. Mm-hmm. I'm just myself, mm-hmm. you know, like we're talking, but if I had to leave here, go on a stage in 20 minutes and perform in front of 80,000 people, then I do it at the best of my ability. Then I go off the stage and, you know, mosey on down the street, maybe go to a bookstore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I take things in stride, and I think that's probably has been sort of a saving grace. You know, I don't dress any different. I wear the same clothes when I get up in the morning to come here, to go on mm-hmm. stage, mm-hmm. to, you know, I'm just myself.
Let me set a little something up against the guitar string ripping. This is Mercy Is. This is from 2014, Noah, music from the motion picture, a lullaby written for Darren Aronofsky's 2014 sort of biblically inspired epic film, Noah, written by Lenny Kaye. Patti Smith recorded this live with the Kronos Quartet. It's the first time she ever recorded with live strings.
Mercy is as mercy does, wandering the wild. The stars are
Patti Smith, 2014. Mercy is. Caroline in Rutland, Vermont. You're on the air with Patti Smith.
Hello, Caroline.
Hello. Well, incredible honor to speak to you. One of my most important spiritual icons, and your music is so transcendent, and your creative force is so spiritually powerful. I wondered how I read that you had met with the Pope in Europe, and he had invited you to play at the Vatican in his Christmas concert. And I wondered what your impressions are of him and as a spiritual being on this planet.
Are we talking Pope Francis, Caroline?
Yes. Pope Francis.
Patty?
And thank you. I just want to thank you for
You're
your
welcome.
Gift.
Well, I was asked to sing at the Vatican Christmas concert with the Vatican Orchestra. I sang O Holy Night and a William Blake poem set to music. And I played People of the Power with my daughter and the orchestra. I was privileged to meet the Pope just for a moment. I mean, just a few moments with him. You feel his tremendous love, generosity, and sense of humor. I think that he is a very important leader in the 21st century. I'm so glad that he is here because he's concerned. He is Catholic, obviously. He's the Pope. But I really feel that he is concerned about all humanity, everyone. He's concerned about our planet. He's concerned about the environment. He is, to have an environmentally concerned Pope is very, very important, especially in a time with severe climate change. I think that he's an important voice, and he also is not afraid to say what he thinks. And I think that all of our political leaders could learn a little about guts from him.
Patty, you write at one point in M-Train, you say, all doors are open to the believer. What do you mean by that?
Oh, my gosh. Could I read something instead? I could.
Take whatever answer you give.
Well, I'll read you this little part. Mm-hmm. I think that this... I believe in movement. I believe in that lighthearted balloon, the world. I believe in midnight and the hour of noon. But what else do I believe in? Sometimes everything, sometimes nothing. It fluctuates like life flitting over a pond. I believe in life, which one day each of us shall lose. As a child, I thought I would never grow up, that I could will it so. And then I realized quite recently that I had crossed some line, unconsciously cloaked in the truth of my chronology. How did we get so damn old, I say to my joints, my iron-colored hair. Now I am older than my love, my departed friends. Perhaps I will live so long that the New York Public Library will be obliged to hand over the walking stick of Virginia Woolf. I would cherish it for her and the stones in her pocket, but I would also keep on living, refusing to surrender my pen. I guess simply, I believe in life. I love being alive. And because, you know, when you have enthusiasm, which is akin to belief and hope, does open doors. And, well, I'm not very analytic, so I hope that explains it.
I'm with you there. Believe in life. I'm for that. I mean, it's funny. You start out that beautiful passage sounding a little like Kevin Costner in Bull Durham, and then you take it in way into Patti Smith territory. Dessa in Matthews, Virginia. Dessa, you're on with Patti Smith.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Patti.
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say you and I are the same age. I have followed you since Horses, and I want to thank you. You have never, ever sold out. And that means everything. When Phil Oakes committed suicide, Harry Chapin wrote The Parade Still Passes By, and he said, even when you weren't selling, you never, ever sold out. And I think that's the biggest thank you I can give you. You never have ever sold out. And thank you for that.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, we do the best we can. But don't forget, some people make choices sometimes that are the best for them at that period of time. And so we have to step back and sort of figure out why people make the choices or let them make the choices they do. I just tried to make the choices that I thought were right for me.
And I love the way you quote Peter Pan and when instructing Wendy in here, hang in there, think happy thoughts. The world may not always inspire them, but life itself does. And you point us right there. Let me grab one more quick call. Terry in Simsbury, Connecticut. You're on with Patty Smith.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Patty.
Hi.
First, I just want to thank you for Just Kids. I felt like I was reading my own story. In my early 20s, I lived on St. Mark's Place, loved a man who, of course, went on to break my heart and die, and it was so great. But what I want to hear about, please, is I'm also a big Bruce Springsteen fan, in addition to being a Patti Smith fan. One of my favorite live performances is Because the Night at Madison Square Garden at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame 25th anniversary show. What was that night like for you?
You know, she wrote that with Bruce Springsteen. We've got the original here, but talk about that night, Patty.
Well, I have to say it was technically challenging, but I did the best that I could. It wasn't just Bruce. It was Bono. It was members of U2 and Bruce's band. And, you know, it was exciting. I mean, it wasn't just because of Bruce and the musicians, though. It was the people. I don't know if I had ever performed at Madison Square Garden, so all of those people in New York City singing along with the chorus, it was awesome.
Patti Smith, it's awesome to have you. It is every single time. I hope you'll come and talk with us again. Very much alive and kicking and beautifully poetic.
Yes.
In a new memoir, M Train. Thank you, Patti.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.